evidence of what really happened to Carmen's baby, but we all know abortion advocates will say anything to advance their cause, even calling murder miscarriage. Talk about a miscarriage of justice. This is Austin Rusev, CFAM for the UN Minute. For more information, go to c-fam.org.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest today is Derek Miedema. He comes to discuss the very unfortunate news about the Supreme Court decision in Canada striking down the prohibition against physician-assisted suicide. Derek is widely published in the National Post, the Ottawa Citizen, Montreal Gazette. He's discussed these issues and associated issues on radio and television. He comes out of call it a Calvinist background. He went to Calvin Theological Seminary in Michigan and graduated as undergraduate from Redeemer University College. And he is at the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada specializing on just this issue, assisted suicide. Derek, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Why don't you tell our listeners exactly what the bad news of February 5th was and how it's been received in Canada.
Well, the Supreme Court of Canada, as you mentioned, struck down our law prohibiting assisted suicide and actually opened the door to euthanasia. But this decision didn't strike down the law right away. What they've done, it would be similar if in the U.S. the Supreme Court struck down a law and gave Congress a year to craft a new one. That's what's happened in Canada. They've given our Parliament a year to make a new law, but they've effectively then said that they must make a law that basically opens the door very, very broadly to allow assisted suicide to a whole range of people. We'd be basically, if that judgment stands, we'd be basically starting off where countries in Europe are today, and that's well down the line in terms of, bringing in more and more and more people who can have assisted suicide and die that way.
Talking to Derek Miedema from the Institute of Marriage and Family in Canada, in the particular decision, I believe it was the Carter versus Canada decision of February 5th, was there a distinction made between assisted suicide based upon emotional and psychological needs and actual physical needs? Was that distinction even made?
No, in my reading of the case, the Supreme Court merely says that a person must be suffering. They must be suffering, continual suffering, grievous suffering, and irremediate. And they don't make a distinction at all between physical and mental suffering. And when I say irremediate, the court goes on to clarify that irremediate means that, for example, someone facing cancer, they wouldn't have to take chemo. They could just go straight to assisted suicide. And so
I've never heard the word irremediate.
No, I haven't.
Is that a new word? It is to me.
Well, it is to me as well, but it basically, you know, as I said, it basically means that anyone can turn down any treatments. If there was pain medication for someone who is writhing in pain, for example, that could control that pain, they wouldn't have to take that. They wouldn't have to take that treatment.
But how would you even know if death is certain in that case?
Well, it's not a case. As the court has ruled, this has nothing to do with being 6 months or a year or however long you'd
say. It just has to do with suffering?
It just has to do with suffering. And it has to do with unbearable suffering as defined by the individual. So
this is beyond nuts. I'm sorry, Derek, but your Supreme Court has done something that's just, it's just ridiculous. May I say that?
I totally agree. This is making everything relative to the individual. It includes illnesses, injuries. So it includes people with disabilities. It's way beyond the pale. They have just opened the door so broadly that it's going to, you know, it's not just going to make it available to a lot of people. It's going to put a lot of people who don't want to die this way under pressure to do so.
Yeah, by family members who consider them a burden, or even by the state who considers them a financial burden.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, you know, both of those situations bang on. If you have so-called greedy heirs, they could work this to their advantage to kill you a bit early and get your money.
You always have greedy heirs, Derek.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, the sad reality with the way this is assisted suicide in particular is practiced in Oregon and Washington, for example, is that once I get a for assisted suicide, I have to go to my doctor. He would approve me to get the prescription. He'd write me out a prescription. I'd go to the pharmacy and get the pills. Once I take them home, there's no oversight. And so, if my wife wanted to kill me to get an early grab of my life insurance policy, she could mix it into my milk, grind it up, mix it into my milk without me knowing, and I could be gone. It's just a horrible, horrible decision.
I'm 65, Derek. How old are you?
I'm in my early 40s.
I mean, I never thought I would live to see such nonsense accepted by much less by educated jurists, but really by popular acclaim at all. I mean, how is the Canadian public reacting to this decision?
Well, unfortunately, public opinion appears in Canada to be strongly in favor of assisted suicide, but the reality is that people who are in favor of it, most of them don't know what they're actually in favor of, and I think if the Canadian public, broadly speaking, drilled down into what this decision actually means, they would be horrified.
Now, they're going to have, since the Supreme Court of Canada has basically made a decision that requires the Canadian Parliament to write up legislation governing assisted suicide, there's going to be a period of time in which the public can be educated about the very things that you're telling us about. You know, that it basically, you know, it's about unbearable suffering as defined by the person who is suffering, right?
Yeah.
Do you think once these details get out to the Canadian public, do you think opinions will change?
Well, I think, personally, I think that process is going to take longer than a year. And it's actually very hard. The voices like mine who are against assisted suicide and are trying to get this out are in the vast minority in Canada. And I think, you know, you've experienced a similar thing in the States in terms of, now why am I blanking on her name? She moved from California to Brittany Maynard. She moved from California to Oregon and had assisted suicide in
right.
Oregon, 29 years old. The voices in favor of that far outweighed the voices against, in the media at least. And so we have our work cut out for us, for sure we do.
Now, you're a serious Protestant. How are the church leaders, both Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish, what are they saying publicly about this decision?
Very little that I'm aware of that church leaders are saying about this. and very little said in my limited experience in terms of my own experience in terms of being involved. Do I hear this issue from the pulpit? And it's actually very troubling that it's become clear we can't count on a unanimous opinion against assisted suicide
from the people of faith
here in Canada.
From the people of faith.
No. No, we can't. And to me, that's, you know, I would say an abrogation of Orthodox Christian understanding.
Oh, big time. But, you know,
Derek,
I'm wondering here if publicly you could make the point that, look, we all understand the feeling of compassion to help someone avoid terrible suffering. And then the option of an individual to make that decision for themselves without any oversight, without anyone counseling them, cautioning them, and checking out, frankly, if they're in a state of mind that is clear enough to make a decision of that importance.
Well, the Supreme Court bought the idea that medical doctors themselves, physicians, are in a perfect position to be able to do that on an individual basis. So by do that, I mean to judge whether a person is clear-minded, whether a person is or is not being pressured to make this decision, whether a person is depressed. Physicians, they say, are in a position to do that. But, you know, when you're talking depression, when you're talking are they being pressured? I don't know that most general practitioners or family doctors would be in a position to really flag those kind of issues. And if there is no, you know, the possibility exists in Canada, and I hope and pray this doesn't happen, but if the Parliament of Canada doesn't create a new law within a year, then the law, with the exceptions that the Supreme Court's made, in other words, anyone in the situations that I've described can have assisted suicide, and then it's basically a free-for-all. It's up for provinces to make their own rules. So I think the whole concept of, you know, having proper oversight, having someone counsel, that isn't even a consideration for the court at this point.
I'm talking with Derek Miedema, who is a Canadian, and he's with the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada. His specialty is assisted suicide and the demographic dimensions of that issue. And he's also published a book, which we'll talk about later in the show, about the impact of gambling on family life. That was so interesting. I told him I wanted to make sure we touched on that. And, of course, the gambling dimension of assisted suicide is pretty significant as well, because it seems to me that one, you know, so many people, Derek, suffer from depression.
Mm-hmm.
So many people, you know, suffer from depression, whether it's based on loss of a person, loss of a job, tough marriage. It could be just a, you know, chemical imbalance that hasn't been addressed. Could be postpartum depression. There's so much depression. It seems to me that you could create a scenario in which the solution to depression is physician-assisted suicide.
Mm-hmm. I think that appears to me. I have to make clear that I'm not a lawyer, but from my reading of the Supreme Court's decision, that's entirely within what they have proposed.
So if you go into a psychiatrist, they could say, well, you can take Xanax, you can take Prozac, or you can take this, and you won't exist anymore. I mean, I don't think I'm caricaturing the situation.
No, I don't think you're making a caricature either. I think in terms of the one that comes right to mind for me, someone who's diagnosed with cancer and the doctor says to them, you can either have chemo and radiation, which is going to ravage your body, which is going to cause all these side effects and which may or may not put you into remission, or you can have these pills. Then you've got the prospect of the suffering for you and your family. You've got the prospect of the cost of chemo on one side, and you've got a $100 or $200 cost for the pills and no suffering, an instant end on the other. That puts people who want chemotherapy in the situation of having to justify why they should. From your example, it puts people who want Prozac in the position of having to justify why they want that instead of assisted suicide. And so this has the potential to spin out. It's not just for people who are terminally ill. This has the potential to spin out into all sorts of situations for people in their everyday life meeting with the doctor where they have proposed that they can kill themselves as a solution to their suffering.
Derek Miedema, why is suffering an evil? I mean, the assumption behind all this is that suffering itself is an evil and justifies taking your own life. I mean, who decided that suffering was an evil?
Well, I'm not exactly sure who decided that. I think that it's been a movement away in broader society, a movement away from towards that view. Certainly in broader culture, there's no concept that suffering can be redemptive, and there's no concept that you can grow and learn as a human being through suffering. Suffering is just seen as something that's bad, and if we can get around it or if we can avoid it, we must. And I don't know exactly where that came from. I think there's some things that have been, high points that have been traced in getting that through. The Clint Eastwood's movie Million Dollar Baby, for example, and many efforts in popular media to get that message out. And it appears that, a large portion of the Canadian population has basically drunk that Kool-Aid.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you look at it just from a common sense point of view, we embrace suffering to achieve a lot of things in life. And we embrace suffering to defend our country. We embrace a certain kind of suffering to, succeed in life, working hard, working late hours. Women embrace suffering to have children. Athletes embrace great suffering to excel in what they do. I mean, there's all kind of suffering which is, you might not call it redemptive, but you can certainly say it's just part of achieving the goods of life, right? Mm-hmm. And holding on to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what is it that makes suffering all of a sudden being moved over to the evil category is the fact that some suffering just isn't desirable, or some suffering isn't seen as part of life's plan and purpose, that it's something that we don't deserve. I don't deserve this suffering, therefore I can use it as a justification to check out from life.
Well, I think what we've seen in Canada and in the States, too, is that every effort on the other side of the issue is just made to make it an issue of my body, my choice. And therefore, if anyone tries to say that I can't, what right do you have to tell me I can't? And
right.
In terms of how suffering got to be seen that way, I mean, I think that suffering unto death, so to speak, can be seen differently as suffering for childbirth or suffering to from their perspective, not from mine. But they might make the distinction between suffering to death and suffering to win a gold medal or suffering to have a baby or suffering to better yourself. I'm not exactly sure about where that came from.
But there's real, as you say, I mean, the unbearable suffering is to be defined by the individual. So,
yeah.
Did the court give any direction on what kind of standards suffering has to meet other than the subjective judgment of the sufferer?
No. And I think you know, this is what we see going on in places like Belgium and the Netherlands, and that basically means that if I go to the doctor and tell him or her that my suffering is unbearable, they don't have much recourse to deny me. You know, there's
poison ivy. Shingles is terrible.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would. I don't know if shingles fit the bill, but I think with what the court's given us,
you know, the Yankees lost the pennant. I'm just trying to think of things that would. They've got to realize there's a point of absurdity in all this, that people are not to be trusted, especially when they're unbearably suffering. It seems to me that if someone's suffering unbearably, that's about the last kind of mental state you want to rely upon for a judgment of that caliber.
Yeah, and that people are in fact vulnerable to pressure and vulnerable to, you know, different unclear thinking when in that situation.
Let's say you've got $500,000 life insurance policy, and somebody knows that. And by the way, will the life insurance companies pay off on assisted suicide? Aren't there suicide? I thought life insurance is usually canceled in the case of suicide.
Well, to me, that's an interesting question, but I have no expertise to answer yes or no on that.
I'll guarantee you that whatever legislation is pushed through Parliament, it will not allow insurance companies to make suicide an excuse not to pay off life insurance benefits.
Well, you know, the interesting thing for us in Canada is that we have a federal election coming up at the latest in October. And so that really throws a monkey wrench into the process for Parliament, and it is actually a really open question now whether what kind of law on this issue of all issues, what kind of law are they going to be able to craft in 12 months when there's an election in the middle of it that will actually be able to address the ins and outs and the serious nature and the details of an issue like assisted suicide and euthanasia. It's an open question. But again, as I said, if they don't, then we end up with the provinces being able to do whatever they want, and we end up with open season.
And there's going to be a lot of profitability built in for the physicians that get into this business, correct?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if it's a billable service, we have universal health care, and so it's the government that pays. And if the government chooses to make this a billable service in such that they would pay a doctor for helping someone kill themselves, or pay a doctor for injecting someone and killing them,
so they get to set the cost.
Well, yeah, it would all be determined by how much they'd get for that particular procedure, and you know, if it's a popular procedure, then it's an added benefit.
Yeah. Do you remember the Hippocratic Oath?
Yes, I do. Yep.
Wasn't there something about doing no harm to a patient?
Yes, absolutely. But there's, you know, two things that, about that that have changed today. From what I understand, at least in Canada, the Hippocratic Oath isn't said by med students graduating today.
That's what I understand.
And for those places where it still is, it's been morphed and reinterpreted. But it's also come out from the other side of the debate in Canada that doctors justify this by saying that if they allow their patient to remain in suffering and pain, they're doing harm. Then actually helping them kill themselves is not doing harm.
You alluded to it a moment ago, Derek. This sounds like an overlay of the pro-abortion argument. The difference is that we're talking about our own lives rather than the lives of the unborn.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the real difficulty in terms of changing the law on euthanasia in the abortion debate, you have the mother and the baby. The euthanasia debate, it has been defined so radically in Canada and elsewhere that it's my choice, my body. And so it's a tough egg to crack, but it is, as we've talked about earlier, it becomes for us a long-term change the culture effort.
In other words, to fight back against it, it's going to require that?
Well, I think it's going to, you know, we don't know what the what shape the law is going to take, but whatever shape the law takes, two things. First, it's going to open the door, and international experience tells us that once the door opens, it gets opened wider and wider and wider and wider. So then the effort of those of us who are against becomes both changing the law, but it becomes also changing the culture so that people who think they want this, we can educate them, we can walk alongside them, we can advocate for greater advances in pain control and end-of-life care. We can advocate for better and better care at the end of life so that fewer people are asking for this.
I'm talking with Derek Miedema, who is a researcher for the Marriage and Family Canada organization. We've been talking about the Supreme Court decision in Canada on February 5th that struck down a prohibition against physician-assisted suicide, but handed the ball over to the Parliament and, I suppose, to the various provinces to create legislation that would allow for physician-assisted suicide going forward based upon any individual's report of unbearable suffering, which would itself justify the state allowing a physician to terminate their life. And do you think that's a fair summary, Derek?
Well, I think it is a fair summary. The one qualification I would give, and you know, is that we're talking about adults who are able to consent, and that I guess that's not altogether a strong safeguard. We've seen in Belgium and the Netherlands that euthanasia in Belgium is legal for kids. If my 4-year-old, for example, was suffering horribly from cancer and requested euthanasia, and my wife and I agreed, and a psychologist or psychiatrist examined my son and said, yeah, he knows what he's asking for, then he could be killed.
Now that's a completely grisly possibility, but we're going to talk about that and other associated issues with this ruling by the Supreme Court in Canada. Right after this message, we hope all of you are listening. Will join us again in just a few moments.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Dunha-Garmo, co-publisher and editor-in-chief of the Chaldean News. It's a news magazine for the Chaldean community, about the Chaldean community, and for anyone who wants to engage the Chaldean community. As Christians from Iraq, Chaldeans are proud supporters of Ave Maria Catholic Radio. We invest many hours into this monthly news magazine to keep you invested in the community. You can subscribe or advertise today. Contact us at www.chaldeannews.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile. 5% of your mobile plan price goes to a pro-life or Catholic charity at no additional cost to you. More information can be found at CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax-deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Building the apostolate of the laity and leading in the new evangelization. Ave Maria Radio joins EWTN in spearheading the recovery of the American Catholic identity and equipping all Catholics to take co-responsibility for Christ Church.
Hi, Deacon Tom here with a reminder that Ave Maria Radio has some terrific gift ideas for you. Books by our hosts and our guests, recordings on CD, and our new Wi-Fi radios, so you can listen to Catholic radio anywhere in the world, anytime you want, as long as you have a Wi-Fi connection. Just go to our website and click the word store on the right side of the page, just below the EWTN logo. It's an easy way to shop, and you can help Catholic radio at the same time. The website can be found at AveMariaRadio.net.
I'm back with Derek Miedema of the Institute of Marriage and Family in Canada, and we're talking about the recent Supreme Court decision in Canada that swept aside prohibitions against physician-assisted suicide and has asked the various provinces and the parliament to come up with legislation allowing for it. And Derek, just before the break, you mentioned that the Supreme Court did specify that this was for adults only, but isn't it the case that the very logic of the decision opens the door for mercy killing?
I believe so. You know, they said it was cruel. If I can just step back a little bit, this case was brought by a husband and wife who brought her mother over to Switzerland to be killed, and a woman with ALS. And the basic line that the Supreme Court bought was that, you know, I can kill myself right now because I can use my hands, but a woman with ALS, when she gets too far and can't use her hands, she needs help. So the law in Canada is discriminating against those with disabilities, and it would force me, if I got ALS, to kill myself before I could no longer use my hands, because the current law would say that if I get help, it's illegal, but if I kill myself, it's not.
Oh, my Lord.
And so the Supreme Court bought that logic, and because they've defined it so broadly, there's no reason to believe that it wouldn't be expanded. And the wrinkle that we have in Canada is our Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And this court case was brought on the basis of the Charter.
And now, was this charter part of the founding of Canada, or was it added on later?
We were founded in 1867. The charter was brought in 1982. The charter, I believe, marked our official becoming an independent country from the British Empire.
But this rights, you say it's a charter of rights and freedoms?
Yes.
And under what clause does this particular decision originate?
I know that it was Section 7. I'm not able to tell you exactly what that
is. Is it something like choosing your own path to happiness or pursue well-being or something like that?
With the right to life. That the argument that I just gave to you, mm-hmm. that the law as it stands now, because Parliament has a year to change it, I'm trying to use the right word here. The law stood against those who were in a situation of not being able to kill themselves, because it would force them to kill themselves earlier than they might if they had the right to assisted suicide, and therefore the right to life was damaged.
Wow. What a twist.
I agree.
So if I have, let's say I have a 12-year-old son or daughter who has a horrible disease and is suffering unbearably, isn't the next Supreme Court case going to be someone who comes and says, look, we allow adults who are suffering unbearably the option of ending their lives. Here's my daughter. She's a human being. She should have all the rights and freedoms of adults, especially when it comes to a case of unbearable suffering. Cannot I, as the adult and guardian of my child, make a decision to, with her consent, to end her life?
Well, I think that's coming down the pipe, certainly, because if it's a charter right for adults to have access to assisted suicide, why should your 12-year-old daughter have to wait till she's 18?
I mean, you have a couple of, like in the United States, you have several media platforms that are quite powerful,
mm-hmm.
Both print, so-called print, and television. Have you got any outcry from any of these, you know, major media sources about the stupidity of this decision?
No outcries from editorial boards. One editorial board urging caution on the issue of assisted suicide, but no one crying out at the nature of the decision and how twisted it is. No.
No public intellectuals who get paid any attention to saying anything?
Well, There have been some. As I say, those articles, whether it's on those mentions in so-called print or in television or on the web, are vastly outnumbered by those in favor.
And again, you've had no statements that you know of from any institutional entities representing the Catholic faith, the Protestant faith, or denominations, and so forth.
I haven't.
I mean, I'm sure the Bishops' Conference of Canada must have said something. And,
I'm sure.
Well,
I know that.
But the point is, they obviously don't have much clout, or this wouldn't be as widely accepted as it seems to be. Have you done at the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada any polling on this?
No, we haven't done any polling on this issue, but I know that what's happened in Canada, and this happened similar, I'm a little bit familiar with the 2009 legalization of assisted suicide in Washington, what happened in that debate and what's happened in Canada, that if you mention God as your basis for this decision, the response is basically, he's your God, not mine, you have no right to shove him down my throat. So that makes it really difficult for the bishops or anyone speaking from a Christian perspective to have any effect on the broader societal discussion.
Well, I do have one statement from Archbishop Paul-André Durocher of Quebec, who is president of the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops. He says, helping someone commit suicide, however, is neither an act of justice or mercy, nor is it part of palliative care, and that's pain, pain killing. The decision of the Supreme Court of Canada today does not change Catholic teaching. And then Archbishop Miller of Vancouver, who's a friend of mine, by the way, is deeply troubled by the court's decision to overturn the law. So you have individual bishops, and I'm sure there must be Protestant leaders who are concerned as well.
I know that the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada, which is a member-based organization of evangelical denominations in Canada, has spoken out strongly against this. I know that here in Ottawa, it's called the Catholic Organization for Life and Family.
Yes, I see them quoted here in this article. So Michelle Boulevard,
right,
the head of that organization.
If I haven't heard of them, doesn't mean they don't exist, certainly.
And of course, the challenge in pro-life work is for the various organizations and leadership to pool their resources and to try to, leverage everybody's resources in order to, like you say, try to change the culture on issues like this. I mean, I'm not familiar with Canadian television or radio, but have you had in those media in Canada the same thing we've had in the United States, where you have television shows kind of celebrating the gay lifestyle and so forth, and television shows probably showing assisted suicide in its sort of most compassionate light? Have you had these kinds of things going on?
Well, yeah, I know we do. I know that the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which is our, it's analogous to the PBS, except that it's government funded.
Yes, completely.
It's a big difference, obviously. But they have been a big cheerleader for assisted suicide. Different papers have done a whole series. One journalist did a whole series on people with Huntington's disease and people with different diseases and how they were, how they wanted assisted suicide, how they had helped to die, actually. There have been major media outlets that have been big cheerleaders for this change, in fact.
And what I don't understand is, I mean, I can understand someone going to great lengths to champion the cause of palliative care. And I know enough about palliative care to know that in the last 20 years, the ability to manage pain, even in the worst circumstances, has become quite significant.
Yeah, agree. Like I know I've spoken with a palliative care doctor from British Columbia, Dr. Margaret Cottle, and she said, you know, that today, for example, if you're in horrible pain, it's not a matter of being unconscious or writhing in pain as the only two options. They're able to adjust pain medications to minute levels in order to get you to the point of having your pain controlled and being aware, and being, you know, being aware. There's still a ways to go, but they have made huge leaps and bounds in terms of pain control. And it's been presented in the popular media, though, at end of life, your choice is either horrible suffering or death. They discount the option of palliative care. And the other thing that's happened with palliative care, if I make the argument on radio or TV or in print that palliative care is the answer instead of assisted suicide or euthanasia, then the response is palliative care is great, but there'll always be a few people palliative care can't help, and for those people we need assisted suicide. Well, the Supreme Court decision proves that that argument is a lie, because this is well beyond those few that palliative care can't help.
Talking to Derek Miedema about a subject that's, as I talk to him, I'm getting increasingly upset about it. I was pretty upset to begin with. Why is there so much energy behind this effort to end people's lives? I mean, they would say, wouldn't they, that is compassion, correct?
Yep. Yeah, they would claim that that's compassion. They would claim that this is dying with dignity, and that they have the corner on that phrase. I wonder, I've heard it said that, a large portion of the Canadian and U.S. population, the baby boomers, is getting older. Those who are in favor of this have tried to frame this as the last great human right. We have the control over this area and this.
Have you heard that said?
Well, I've heard or read that argument.
Yeah.
This is the last great right. We need to have control
what about,
over.
Wouldn't there be one more right, the one we just discussed, the mercy-killing right? In other words, if I have the right to put myself out of my own misery, why don't I have the right to put you out of your misery?
Well, it's going to be...
Because it's based on the same principle, isn't it?
Well, it is.
That a life is not worth living where there is suffering deemed unbearable by this person who's suffering.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, on one hand, it's a huge jump between killing myself and killing someone else. But on the other hand, you're right. That's the understanding under this. You know, I've heard from people with disabilities that they've had people to say to them to their face,
yeah,
I'd rather be dead than in your situation.
Right. How dare you live on?
Yeah, well, and when you have the option of assisted suicide entered in, then those kind of statements are coupled with the availability of death.
It's kind of like the mothers with six or seven kids who go into the grocery store and they get scowls.
Yep.
You know, how dare you bring so many children into the world?
Yep.
I mean,
yeah, and I can, I have a severely handicapped twin, for example, who lives in a group home and has a monthly stipend from the government.
Right.
And I could see people in his situation facing challenges that, why do you keep living? You're costing us all money. You know, we could save so much money if my brother was dead. It rolls out to we could talk for hours, and we could not exhaust the number of situations that this ruling is going to affect. And it depends how the Parliament legislates, or if they do. But it's hard to believe that Parliament will be able to create a law which locks the door on this. They're going to have to open it up one way or another.
Do you think that are there any provinces that are conservative enough or have enough, say, religiously, seriously constituents that will any provinces resist doing this?
I don't.
What about Alberta, for example?
Well, you know, Alberta is an interesting province in the sense that I think they also have a bent that says we're different here, we're individuals, we control our own destiny, libertarians who may well just buy the idea that I should be in control of my own life, I should be in control of my own death. I don't know that there's one province that I would pick out. Alberta would be one that would come to mind, but just for the reasons I stated, I wonder even about that one. And, you know, Quebec has passed a law to legalize assisted suicide and euthanasia, very similar to what the Supreme Court ruled. And there have already been Ontario mused when that law was passed. Oh, that's interesting. We'll see how it goes. Maybe we should go there, too. So we have pressure from the Supreme Court on the federal level. We have also pressure on the province level, equivalent to the state level. And it's what's happening in the states too, right? People are saying in the states, why, Brittany Maynard argued, why should I have to go to Oregon to die? I should be able to die in California. I've understood that people in the border states to Canada are beginning to say now, why should I have to go to Canada to get killed? I should be able to stay home and get killed. There's this pressure to expand access, and so that's happening on two fronts for us in Canada. It's a very trying time.
You have in Canada several dominant political parties with their leadership. I mean, is there going to be any voice coming forth from any of these parties, these leaders, that will question the wisdom of moving in this direction?
Well, there have been, we have three parties. We have the Conservatives, the Liberals, and the New Democratic Party. And I'm not sure exactly how they'd equate to Republican and Democrat in the States. Conservatives being more right of center, Liberals being more center, although they're both very close to the center, the NDP being more left. The Conservative Party is the one party that has said strongly we're against this, although they do have individual members who...
They have officially said they're opposed to assisted suicide.
Yes.
Ah.
There are members of the NDP, the left party, who have actually pushed the idea of expanding palliative care, as opposed to euthanasia and assisted suicide. The Liberal Party is kind of a wild card. They would seem to be in favor, but I'm not sure how that's going to play out. So this will actually become, because the Supreme Court released their decision a couple of days ago, if we have an election between now and October, you can bet this is going to be an election issue as well.
Do you think the Conservatives will start running away from it for fear it'll cost them votes?
Well, they've already shown signs of that in the sense that one of the unique things that's built into the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms is something called the Notwithstanding Clause. And the Notwithstanding Clause would allow the Government of Canada to override the Supreme Court decision for 5 years. It would have to be reexamined and redone every 5 years. They have the option of using that. They have already come out publicly saying that's not a likely option. That would be politically toxic, and my impression is they really don't want to touch it. In terms of what kind of legislation comes out, I'll have to wait and see. The abortion issue has been toxic in Canada. No one's willing to touch it. I sincerely hope that this issue, assisted suicide and euthanasia, isn't such that we end up with no law in a year. But we'll have to continue working and do our best to push our elected officials to do good work on this and come up with the best law possible, unfortunately.
I'm talking with Derek Miedema, who is with the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada. And as I said when I introduced you, Derek, that you've done some interesting work on gambling and its impact on the family. And, of course, in Canada and in the United States, the governments, especially the states here, are in the business of gambling. And if our listeners don't mind, I'd like to get, you know, some of your insights into the impact of gambling on broken families. I mean, is this mainly a financial cause of brokenness? I mean, is it that money is lost and families break up, or are there other reasons why gambling impacts the family?
Well, it is financial. It may even have its roots in financial, but those damages spin out in all sorts of ways. I know that, in 2008, for example, publicly available data shows that that gambling is particularly a tax on the poor. Households with incomes of less than $20,000 spent about twice as much as a percentage of their income as did households with incomes of $80,000 or more. So the
but by tax, you mean tax metaphorically, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, metaphorically, absolutely.
I mean, it's not an actual obligation. It's just that they are buying twice the number of lottery tickets.
Yep, spending twice as much as a percentage of their income, spending twice as much, and that becomes government revenue that goes into the government coffers.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that the big issue that I found out is that you have in the research to different classes of gamblers: pathological gamblers who are slightly addicted, and gamblers who can set a limit and not go over it. And what tends to happen in the U.S. and in Canada is the line that, in Canada, the research showed that only about just over 3% of the adult population in Canada was pathological gamblers.
That's a big percentage.
It is a big percentage, but we get the message that it's only that 3%. So if it's only 3% and 97% of gamblers are able to gamble responsibly, then what's the big issue?
No, if you go from you don't go from pathological to non-pathological, there's got to be a big spread of
a big spread, like moderately addicted. And when I talk about pathologically gambling, you're looking at someone who would spend so much that they would have to borrow, they would have to they would have to lose their house. Some of them might go to the mob, depending where they're related, but they would rack up huge debts to the detriment of their family and to the detriment of, they'd spend all their money on gambling. Moderate gamblers, gambling, the Canadian Association for Mental Health, if I can go this way, it defines problem gambling this way. It says gambling is a problem when it gets in the way of work, school, or other activities, when it harms your physical or mental health, when it hurts you financially, when it damages your reputation, or when it causes problems with your family or friends. So you can think of pathological gamblers as ticking off all the boxes to the nth degree. You can see moderate gamblers as ticking off most of the boxes to a moderate degree. And you can see gamblers who can set a limit and play to it and not go over it as maybe having one or two of those.
Now, what do you say to the people who just say, look, Derek, I mean, gambling is just like drinking. Nobody's forcing you to do it. And if your argument is that enough people abuse it that it should be completely done away with, then you got to apply that to other things as well.
Well, I don't buy that argument, frankly. I look particularly at the issue of gambling, and that I know that in 2008, that 3% of gamblers who were pathological gamblers contributed 23% of gambling revenues.
Whoa! But that's huge.
And only less than half of all adult Canadians gambled at all. So we're looking at a huge proportion of government gambling revenue that comes from addicts. And the reality is, I found research that says that you're looking at 3 to 5, I think, people per problem gambler. So if you imagine I was a gambler who was spending all the mortgage money on gambling and all the money to pay the electricity bills and natural gas bills, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My wife and kids suffer. I spoke to someone in a small town in Ontario who said that they would have families, for example, the summer camps. Children could families could apply for help to pay for summer camp if they didn't have the money. She would have families coming to them when they presented their financials. They made more than enough money to cover the cost, but they couldn't because their loved one was gambling. And so they deal with, even applying for help to pay for summer camp, they deal with the stigma that they have to show these financial documents, and everyone knows that that gambling is the reason they can't pay for that. But so my wife and kids are going to suffer if I steal from my employer to cover my gambling addiction. My employer is going to suffer. My parents are going to suffer. My in-laws are going to suffer. My siblings are going to suffer. It just extends farther and farther out. So that 3.2% becomes a huge chunk of the Canadian population when you actually look at it that way.
I want to remind our listeners that I've been talking to Derek Miedema, who is a researcher at the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada. And he's an expert on assisted suicide, on its impact on demographics, and obviously also on social problems and personal familial problems caused by gambling. Derek, you've been a great guest. I hope you'll come back again and be with us on Church and Culture.
Oh, I'd be glad to do that.
Because a lot of what goes on in Canada makes its way down here and vice versa, so we have to be talking to each other.
Absolutely, we do.
So, Derek Miedema, thank you so much for being our guest on Church and Culture. And to those of you who have been listening today, please join us after this short message for another very interesting guest.
The Holy Trinity Apostolic Lenten Symposium is Saturday, March 14th, and this year's theme is the healing power of Jesus. Archbishop Alan Vigneron is this year's keynote speaker.
Hello, I'm Archbishop Alan Vigneron, and I want to invite all of you to the 18th Annual Lenten Symposium of the Holy Trinity Apostolate. The program is wonderful, and I look forward to being with you. My own topic is the Christian family as the agent of truth and mercy in the new evangelization. I hope to be with you there.
Other speakers include Auxiliary Bishop Francis Race, Dr. Janet Smith of Sacred Heart Major Seminary, Renewal Ministries President Ralph Martin, Fathers Peter Glass and Luigi Gabri, and Sister Sarah Marie Kuhl. The symposium is at St. Cyril Methodius on Ryan and 18 Mile in Sterling Heights. There's a youth symposium for ages 14 through 17. For ticket information, go to HolyTrinityApostolate.com and register, or call 313-277-8905. That's 313-277-8905.
From Wall Street to prison walls, Dale Rosanella was a high-paid Wall Street finance lawyer and is now a volunteer lay chaplain and spiritual advisor to men on Florida's death row. What brought about this dramatic life change? Hi, this is Peggy Stanton, inviting you to tune in to Power from the Pews to hear Dale Rosanella's eye-opening testimony. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
Father John Ricardo concludes his new series on the next edition of Christ is the Answer. After going through the Alpha Course, many of his parishioners wanted more for a still closer walk with our Lord. On the seventh and concluding episode of The Next Necessary Step, Father Ricardo's title is Surrender and Wrap-Up. Listen to Christ is the Answer, Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday afternoons at 5, and Sunday mornings at 11 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the answer.
Christ is the answer is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
This is Life News Radio. I'm Jim Anderson. Martin Pistorius, the man who doctors alleged to be in a vegetative state but in reality was fully aware of his surroundings, is telling more of his story. He is now saying how his faith in God pulled him through not only that poor assessment, but also through abuse at the hands of a caregiver. In a case too close for comfort to the death of Tanya Reeves in Chicago, Operation Rescue has transcripts of a 911 call for medic units to respond to an abortion business in Salem, Oregon. Abortionist Valerie King made the call herself, and her comments raised red flags with dispatchers. She spent most of the call trying to persuade the dispatcher that the patient was really fine. but finally, after 3 minutes, blurted out that her patient had sustained particular injuries in an abortion which made the case a life-threatening medical emergency. This is Life News Radio. We in the pro-life media thank you for being pro-life. We know that for all